We are back on the Andy Finn Show, and today is the 31st of March, and I promised to tell you what three musicians had in common. So it was on this day in 1992 that Bruce Springsteen released two albums. He released Human Touch and Lucky Day. Let's not... This says Lucky Day. It isn't Lucky Day. It's Lucky Town. Weird. Anyway, he could have done a double album, but he released two single albums. And so at the next break, we'll hear a little bit of Bruce. Or we might hear Jimi Hendrix or Cat Stevens. And what did they have in common? It was on this day, March 31st, in 1967, that Jimi Hendrix began his first British tour, and he began it with Cat Stevens. And I'm willing to bet you, I haven't looked back, but I'm willing to bet you that Cat Stevens was the headliner and Hendrix was the warm-up band. Although that doesn't, it's hard to picture the music together. I will give you a taste of music from Cat Stevens' most famous album, Tea for the Tillerman, and a little taste from Jimmy. And if you know anything about Jimmy, you know that he doesn't sound much like Cat Stevens. Anyway, we will hear a little bit of that as we go to the next break. But the other thing that I wanted to talk about here is, let's save that little bit of science. We could save that bit about McCain. No, I guess I'll just cover a little bit of science. It turns out there's some new research on schizophrenia. Now, I don't know if you know anyone who has schizophrenia in your life, but I have a friend who is a schizophrenic, and it's a tough thing to deal with. And I've known a couple of people who've had schizophrenia in their lifetime, and it's not a happy situation. Well, the research shows that there's a much more sophisticated relationship between our genes and schizophrenia than people thought. People kind of thought that there was, you know, maybe a series of damaged genes when you add it all up ended up just giving you schizophrenia. But it turns out that there's a whole range of variations here. It seems to be pretty individual or idiosyncratic. Now, that's good news is they can identify patterns over time. The bad news is there's no one answer or treatment. The other thing they've discovered is that schizophrenia and autism are related. If you take away the hallucinations and the paranoid delusions of schizophrenics, you've got something with symptoms fairly similar to autism. So they are getting to the roots of these things, as they are many things in the human genome, but we still got a ways to go. And that's what I love about science, is that when they figure stuff out, they tell us. And again, just to tie this back to the global warming discussion from the first half, you notice there's nobody out there claiming that the human genome is a hoax, or that subatomic physics is a hoax, or that the science is wrong. There's nobody questioning plate tectonics. There's nobody questioning the theory of cells. There's nobody questioning the theory of gravity. There's only two theories, and people question them because they seem to those people to contradict their religious beliefs. And so they must fight back and question them. It's easier to reconcile your religious beliefs with reality, because that's what science gives us, is a view of reality. Are they wrong sometimes? Sure. But are they right many, many more times than they're wrong in the last 300 years? Yupper. Absolutely. In any case, let me move on to another little piece of science or study. Basically, this was a survey that was commissioned by the Girl Scouts of the USA, and they basically looked at boys and girls in the U.S. and asked them whether or not they planned to be leaders, wanted to be leaders. Now, they did a pretty large sample. They did an online and a mail sample of almost 4,000 people. They got 4,000 respondents. And the kids range from 8 years old to 17 years old. But basically, these are our next set of leaders. And what's interesting, and it may be the way they ask the questions, a majority of them don't really want to be leaders. Maybe they see it as a burden or whatever. But only roughly, what's the right number here overall? They've broken it down into categories by race. And the majority of white students don't want to be a leader. Only 34% of girls and 32% of boys say that they want to be a leader. What's interesting is that among blacks, Hispanics, and Asians, the numbers above 50%, or at 50, right around 50%, for girls and for boys too, except Asians. For some reason, Asian boys don't want to be leaders. Asian girls are the leading category of people who want to be leaders. So it may be what your parents are telling you at home, and it apparently is more true of minorities, blacks, Hispanics, and Asians, that parents are saying to them, you know, you can be a leader. And so they believe it and they want that. I don't think this means much in that I don't think an 8-year-old understands what it means to be a leader. They may think it means to be a scout leader. They may think it means to be president of the United States. You can be a leader in all kinds of fields, all kinds of areas. And it may be that kids just don't understand all that and how all that works. But for whatever reason, the kids of today are not as interested in being leaders as you might think. In any case, the last item I've got here is an obituary. Dith Pran died. Dith Pran was a journalist. He was a human rights activist. And he became the influence that resulted in the movie The Killing Fields. If you remember that movie about the Khmer Rouge and the 2 million people they murdered in Cambodia, the movie portrayed his life. He died on Sunday, and in fact, he died in New Brunswick at the Robert Wood Johnson University Hospital. I used to teach at Rutgers in New Brunswick and have been in that hospital many times. Used to live in Somerset, New Jersey. In any case, he was a witness to and basically helped reveal the horrors of that genocide that was perpetrated by the Khmer Rouge and Pol Pot. So that was in Cambodia right after we left Vietnam. And what's interesting is how the right and the left both play this now. I'm always amazed, and I have to say I don't claim to be an expert on this whole thing, but the original idea of us being in Vietnam was to stop the communists from taking over. The domino theory said is if one country fell, they would all fall to the communists. Well, that didn't happen, and we left, and the North Vietnamese took over. But the Khmer Rouge and what they did in Cambodia, they were hardly this leftist organization, like a communist organization. They killed a lot of their liberals or people on the left. So it's a rather weird analogy, but what people still argue is that we lost Vietnam, and then because of that, we had the tragedy in Cambodia. And I'm going to save this for the second half, but when we get to John McCain's beliefs about the Iraq War, it's tied to his beliefs about the Vietnam War, and we're still fighting the Vietnam War in this regard. The right and the left disagree over the lessons of Vietnam. The right believes the right, correct lesson we should take, and Bush has said this himself when he visited Vietnam a year or so ago, that the lesson of Vietnam for Iraq is that if you leave, you lose. No, that's not the lesson. But when we come back, I'll tell you the lesson. And in the meantime, we are going to listen to Bruce Springsteen talk to us from his album, Lucky Town. No, this is from Human Touch. He wants it all, or he wants nothing at all.
Yeah.
Andy Finn, and I am begging you to listen to my show at www.andyfinn.us.
The Andy Finn Show, Uncommon Talk Radio.
We are back on The Andy Finn Show, and today is March 31st. On this day in 19... I shouldn't tell you the answer. I should ask the question. So daylight savings time went into effect for the very first time in the United States on this date. What year do you think daylight savings time began? Now, keep in mind, we moved it 2 weeks earlier. I think it was 2 weeks, maybe it was 3 weeks, a year or two ago to save additional energy. So instead of waiting until the first weekend in April, and I guess it was the end of March back then, they moved it into earlier in March. As you know, we switched a couple weeks ago. But the year was 1918 that we ended up with daylight savings time. So let's talk a little bit about the situation in Iraq, because we've been hearing for quite some time that the surge is working. And I'd love for the surge to work, but it's not that simple. So let me recap what I've told you before. If you are a regular listener, you know my take on the surge. There are three reasons the violence has gone down in the last 9 months. And the surge is the third reason. The most important reason is that Muqtada al-Sadr, the Shiite cleric who has about 10,000 militia under his control, and I use that term loosely because he doesn't have control of all of them, Muqtada, as I like to call him, Muqtada al-Sadr, declared a ceasefire for 6 months. He redeclared it a few weeks ago, but he does have these roving bands. Now, they were killing hundreds of people and slitting their throats and cutting off their heads and shooting them in the back of the head and dumping the bodies on the streets. And a year ago this time and into last summer, we were finding, I say we, Americans and Iraqis were finding 100 or more bodies a day on the streets of Iraq. That slowed down because he put the ceasefire into place. He basically said, you know, we're not going to tangle with the Americans. If they're bringing in more troops, we can just wait them out. That's the main reason that violence is down. The second reason violence is down is because the Sunnis in a lot of towns outside of Baghdad were tired of al-Qaeda in Iraq running roughshod over them. The al-Qaeda in Iraq members, who are also Sunnis, but they are insurgents, and they represented 5% of all the insurgents in Iraq a year ago, and probably do to this day, although a lot of them have been killed. The Sunnis turned on al-Qaeda in Iraq, their fellow Sunnis, and said, you know, we're not going to take it. Bum, 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 bum. And that's the second reason why violence is down, is a lot of them have been wiped out, and why our casualties are down, because they took the fight to al-Qaeda in Iraq. We have supplied a lot of support, but this was the issue of we started working with the Sunnis, who some of whom were insurgents themselves against Americans, but then switched and started working with us when they could see that we weren't trying to run roughshod over them and kill their families, but al-Qaeda in Iraq was. But there's no guarantee they will stay our allies when they end up finishing up with al-Qaeda in Iraq. In fact, that's the thing that Maliki's government has been worried about and the Shiites have been worried about, is that we're making a bargain with the devil by making a bargain with the Sunnis, who used to be our enemy over there. Given all of that, then the third reason is the surge. We had the influx of troops and things have stabilized somewhat. But what I've been predicting all along, not hoping for, but predicting, is that there's a limit to how long this can hold, because this is kind of a fragile ceasefire. Bottom line is, we've got competing groups in Iraq that want power. They want money. And there's a lot of oil over there, and there's difficulties sharing the power and the money. So what experts have expected since Bush and Cheney went in is that it doesn't matter when we leave. But when we leave, there's likely to be a bloodbath. They are going to go after each other, and violent forces will be unleashed. Now, the Bush-Cheney approach, and John McCain signs on to this, is essentially, we need to keep the lid on things until the government can get strong enough. No, that's not the answer. And the reason why Obama is right and Clinton is right that we have to pull out is that when we pull out, there will be more violence. But it's going to happen no matter when we pull out. Meanwhile, we are spending treasure and lives to the tune of, well, we're down well below 100 deaths per month, but we were averaging over 100 deaths a month for quite some time, and I'm not saying we're going to get back there, but deaths are, our American deaths and other deaths are on the rise in Iraq again. But we're also spending some ridiculous amount. What is it now? If it's 150 billion, it's more than 10 billion a month, so it's more than 2.4 billion a week. We're spending something like 10 billion a month over there, and it may actually be higher now. we're paying larger bonuses to our soldiers because we can't get them to reenlist or can't get new enlistments. And we're paying these Sunnis, and of course we say we're going to pay them. Apparently we haven't been paying all of them, and some of them are turning on us. The point is that things are starting to deteriorate in Iraq again, and it was kind of predictable. Maybe we'll be able to put a lid on it again, but basically there have been some articles in the Washington Post in the last week. The one in Sunday's Outlook section that was interesting I'm moving away from Iraq and moving over to Afghanistan for this one. The headline says, like the Wild Wild West, plus Al-Qaeda. So it describes how much trouble the British are having in particular, but how much trouble we are having keeping a lid on things in Afghanistan. On the border of Pakistan, the Taliban are back in control of large swaths of Afghanistan in the mountains, and there's no sign we're going to be able to control them anytime soon. Another article that was in the paper yesterday was an editorial by David Ignatius, and basically he said that the Bush administration has a choice. They need to start getting to know Mukhtar al-Sadr, and they need to start getting to know Hamas. Now, the Bush administration says, we don't negotiate with bad guys. We don't even talk to bad guys. We want to work with good people. Here's the problem. You have to deal with reality in life. And so the Israelis have known for some time that they're not happy with who's out there, but they have to deal with them. And so if they have to deal with them, they have to deal with them. And it ends up being that you've got to deal with bad guys from time to time. We did with the Soviet Union, and we do today with China. On the other hand, we refuse to deal with Cuba. It's just kind of weird. So Ignatius points out that the reality on the ground requires us to reach some accommodation of some sort with Hamas. They're not going anywhere. The Israelis can't vanquish them. And Mukhtar al-Sadr's not going anywhere. Ultimately, it's going to be the Iraqis that figure out how to make all this work. And let's see. While we're talking about it, the U.S. has stepped up its airstrikes into Pakistan, and these are essentially unilateral. That is, Pakistan is not per se giving us permission. They're willing to look the other way and hope that they don't get publicized. But basically, this is what Barack Obama said he would do if he had actionable intelligence about Al-Qaeda in Pakistan or about Osama bin Laden, and he didn't have an assurance from Pakistan they would go after him. He would authorize airstrikes into Pakistan. Now, most conservatives have put out this line, the Sean Hannitys of the world and others, basically say, even George W. Bush said it. I covered this on the show a couple of weeks ago. Bush was asked what he thought of the candidates. So when he got to Obama, he said, well, all I really know about him, we need to define him better. All I really know about him is that he would attack Pakistan, our ally, and he would meet with Ahmadinejad, our enemy. Or he would make nice, or whatever he said. And of course, that's just a gross distortion. As I pointed out at the time, I so long for a president who's an adult. If you were to ask Bill Clinton about the opposition, he would give you a reasoned and reasonable adult answer. Now, he might be partisan about it, like he would have a point of view, but he wouldn't paint the other side's view as a caricature. And that's what Bush did when he said Obama would attack Pakistan. Well, what's interesting is this is part of the Republican talking points. I was on the phone this past week with a good friend of mine who is a conservative. He's quite conservative. He's a smart fellow. He's a PhD economist. And he naturally prefers McCain in this election. And Obama's, quote, liberal policies worry him. But he used the same line. He said, well, Obama wants to attack Pakistan. No, that's not what he said at all. Obama said months ago he would do what the Bush administration is currently doing. And Hillary said it months ago as well. So the U.S. is now making a few more airstrikes into Pakistan, trying to control the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and maybe get Osama. It'd be nice if Bush could get him before he left office, but I don't think that's going to happen. And let's see, the other side of this, and this is kind of weird, is that basically the situation is complex in Iraq, but the Iraqi government has gone after Mukhtar al-Sadr's militia in Basra and elsewhere. And there's been this on-again, off-again peace, but they have shelled the green zone because of the attacks that we've got. The U.S. is stepping in, and so are the British, and helping out these attacks. But there are analysts who are claiming that all Maliki is doing, the head of the Shiites, is going after these renegade Shiites, or what he considers renegade Shiites. Sadr has had a ceasefire on, but he does have 10,000 or so militants loosely under his control. And the claim by some Iraq experts is that in advance of the upcoming elections, Maliki, head of the government, is trying to clear out Sadr's supporters to make it more likely that he will win the election. Well, it does remain true that Maliki didn't consult with us or even the rest of the Iraqi government before he went after them. It became as a surprise to our leaders. And we're joining the offensive. This is a danger I pointed out a couple of years ago, that we will eventually get to the point when we draw down troops that we will offer airstrikes to support the Iraqi government. And what's to stop them from calling in U.S. airstrikes on people who are just political opponents? We aren't there yet exactly, but there are experts claiming that, in fact, we are there in terms of our support for Maliki against Sadr's insurgents. Now, there are bad guys there. There's some of them that are going out marauding and killing people. Be nice if we could stop them. But we are walking into a field of landmines there, and we need to remember that. Now, what's interesting is we are where we are. The president has gone into defense mode here. He is telling us that there's progress. He hasn't used the phrase lately, we're turning the corner, or it's hard work, but it is hard work, and he probably believes we're turning the corner, but he's basically saying that there's been great progress. When we come back, we will look at the progress.